The time is 10 o'clock. You're listening to KHNS, Haines, Skagway, and Klukwan. The following program is a production of KHNS. Its content does not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the board of directors and staff of Lynn Canal Broadcasting Incorporated, the licensee. Good morning, Heather Lindy.
Good morning, Janine. Here we are again for another Art Matters
Lynn
program.
Canal Art Matters, yeah.
Yeah, we've got a pretty great show lined up for today. With some previewing of First Friday events in Haines. Also, we've got some book recommendation from the Skagway Library.
Yeah.
And some previewing of some of the public events around the Northwoods Writers Conference, which is going on in Skagway right now. This is the first big morning. It was the opening reception was last night. And what else? Oh, we have Judy Jacobson. Judy Hall Jacobson is going to be in talking about her plant and mushroom books. And Hannah Bocart,
yeah. We've got a great
artist,
cast.
Hannah Bocart, who's got a show at the distillery
tomorrow evening.
And what's our big... Oh, and Melina Shields is going to come in, and she's our local reader, and talk about what she's reading. And our big thing is...
Our big thing, Eowyn Ivey, Pulitzer Prize finalist author in the Upper Lynn Canal.
And Eowyn isn't actually still here. She was here this week in Haines, and a little bit earlier in the week. She was here Tuesday in Haines, and I think she was Sunday or Monday in Skagway.
Sunday in Skagway.
And wowed everybody. And we tried to get her to stay just to be on the show, but that wasn't going to work out. So instead, I had a chance to interview her on tape, and we're going to play that. And I get to listen. I've never heard myself talking to somebody in an interview. So I hope this isn't cringeworthy for me, but it's just unedited. We did it just as if it was the show. So
let's delve right in, because she is a guest of honor, and you introduce her in the interview. So
okay,
without further ado, here is a conversation between Heather and Eowyn Ivey on Tuesday.
We have a real treat today on Art Matters. We've got Eowyn Ivey and Eowyn's debut novel, The Snow Child, earned you a place as a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, and it also became an international bestseller. And your new book, To the Bright Edge of the World, tells the story of a 19th century expedition into the Alaskan wilderness and a fictional river, the Wolverine River, which I understand is a lot like the Copper River, but we'll get to that in a minute. But I am so happy to have you here.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here. This is my first time to Haines. You know, until now, my main knowledge of Haines was through your writing. So it's such a treat to actually be here now. It's wonderful.
Well, thanks. And I guess what I'd like to do always on the show is we have our guest introduce himself. So introduce yourself the way you want to be,
okay,
instead of the way I might. I did have to get the Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, it's not something I normally just drop into conversation.
Yeah. So you're not wearing like a medal around your chest or anything. I would.
No,
maybe earrings or something.
I'm still in shock over it, I think, to be honest. So, no. So I'm Eowyn Ivey, and I grew up in the Matanuska Valley. We live about 70 miles northeast of Anchorage, and my husband and I grew up together in that small town. And it's really wonderful. I think one of the wonderful things about the books is that they've gotten me to see parts of Alaska that I've never gotten to see. So the first time I was down to Southeast was with the Snow Child, and this is my first time to Haines, so I'm really excited to be here.
Right, and so Palmer, right? Aren't you a graduate of Palmer High School?
I am a Palmer High alumni. So is my husband, and my oldest daughter just graduated from Palmer High, too. So we're a family of them.
And you also worked for the Frontiersman for a little bit?
I did, yeah. So I worked at the Frontiersman newspaper coming right out of college. I had gone out of state to Western Washington University in Bellingham, and then I needed an internship to finish my degree. So the plan was I was just going to work at the Frontiersman for 6 weeks, long enough to satisfy my internship. Typical Alaskan story. About 9.5 years later, I was still there and had done every job, you know, reporter, covering all the different beats, photographer, page designer, the whole 9 yards. But then I ended up going to Fireside Books out in Palmer after that. So if you ever drive through Palmer, you've got to stop at Fireside Books.
Oh, it's a great bookstore.
It is. And although you have a wonderful bookstore here, too. Yeah. It's really,
we're lucky. Small towns.
You
and
are.
I've got one in Skagway, too.
Yeah. And that's one thing I do want to say, how grateful I am that Brenda down at Hearthside Books in Juneau sort of put the Southeast tour for me together. But working with all the independent booksellers and librarians, Sitka, Ketchikan, Skagway here in Haines and Juneau. So I'm just grateful that they've put me up. They found places for me to stay and flown me and ferried me everywhere.
Hey, you know, I have a question for you because this comes up sometimes about, you know, the idea, the connection between writers and bookstores and writers and readers and, you know, that this is something you do, you know, for a living. Mm-hmm. So how important is it to be in a part of the world where there are a lot of independent bookstores?
Oh, I think, I mean, I really believe that the Snow Child did as well as it did because of independent bookstores starting in the Pacific Northwest, in Alaska and Washington and Oregon. I mean, I really think because, you know, when you're just a writer from Podunk, Alaska, nobody knows who you are. And independent booksellers are so important in sort of this grassroots spreading the word about books. So I just have like endless gratitude. Plus, they're my favorite places to go every time. That's the problem is I always feel like I need an extra suitcase when I travel so I can bring all my books back.
So I have a question about the Snow Child, and I've heard this before that came from working at Fireside and reading fairy tales. And tell that story.
Yeah, and actually my standing joke with David, the owner right now, is that I'm going to have to, I don't work at Fireside Books anymore. When The Snow Child came out, I was just traveling so much. But I keep joking that I'm going to have to go back in there and volunteer to shelve books because that's where apparently all my inspiration comes from. So both novels were actually inspired by things I stumbled across shelving books at Fireside. In the Snow Child case, it was a little, you know, scholastic paperback fairy tale book called The Snow Child, illustrated by Barbara LaValle. A lot of Alaskans will know her art. And it was just this really, it was kind of the little paperback books your children bring home from the book fairs. You know, it was something you could really easily overlook. But I read it and I was just sort of taken over by it because it was the first time I think I had come across sort of a magical fairy tale that could have been set right in my backyard. And I abandoned a different novel that I've been working on for 4 years or something and dove into The Snow Child. So yeah, it was. And then the same case with the new book. It was inspired by a report of an expedition from 1885. It was a rare edition that came in the bookstore that just I brought it home for the evening and just couldn't stop reading it. So
yeah. Now that's, yeah, so it's called To the Bright Edge of the World.
The new one, yeah.
I'm sorry we're on radio because then you can't see the cover. It's just beautiful.
The cover is.
And both of them. Now, I've seen the cover, the English version and the American one, but it's really cool. It's a bird outline and then
you can sort of see the mountains through the outline of the raven. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel, you know, and I think that sometimes is surprising to readers that oftentimes we get, you know, authors published by sort of the big five publishers often don't get a ton of say over our covers. And I have been so fortunate that if I've had concerns, they've listened to me. And mostly in general, I've just been thrilled with the covers. So, yeah, I'm very lucky that way.
So but that's the opposite. I'm not so thrilled.
Oh,
it's a moose and a lemon, but, you know, whatever.
I think your cover, and I do think it's hard because I think your covers are beautiful. And I think that they are looking at a different thing than we are. I have these things like I don't want a tree in my on my cover that doesn't live in Alaska, you know, and they're not concerned about that stuff. So far, so good. I have to say the first cover that the U.S. came out with, I didn't love. And they listened to me for the Bright Edge of the World. And they came up with this other one. And I was like, yay.
Well, let's talk, too, because there's a local connection in the actual expedition that you read right here in Haines. And that expedition originally it was Allen. Right?
Yes,
it was
Lieutenant Henry Allen. Yeah.
So explain this for us.
Yeah. So he. So it was a real expedition. And he started out because, you know, the Department of Columbia headquarters for the military at the time was in Fort Vancouver, right across the river from Portland. But then what they did is they came up the coast, you know, in a big ship, and stopped in Sitka, and along the way going up, and then eventually got to Hinchinbrook Island,
which is around Prince William Sound.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and then had to kind of make their way across the Sound. and then go up the Copper River. And it was an amazing, I mean, I think what surprised me about it so much is what these men went through and survived. And they went up in late winter, early spring, before the Copper River broke up, and they went up over the mountains and floated out on the Tanana on the Yukon to the coast, living on, you know, scraps of dead moose they had found. And I mean, it was pretty
right.
grim.
Pretty unprepared, really.
Very unprepared, yeah.
And you convey that now, and you chose, though, to make it fictional.
I did. So I fictionalized everything. I fictionalized the river. My character is Alan Forrester. So I used the name Alan just to kind of as an homage to this amazing journey this lieutenant did. But my guy is, you know, a colonel. He's older. I gave him a promotion. Mm-hmm. I just wanted the freedom to have my own characters and not feel sort of held down by real people. You know, I've read different historical fiction books that I've really enjoyed. About real people, but it makes me a little uncomfortable as a writer to try to step in, you know, and imagine what this real person would have thought or felt. So this gave me the freedom to do whatever I wanted to do.
Right, right. And see, the local Haines connection is Mark Allen, who works in our harbor.
Right.
And people know he's related to the...
I had forgotten about that.
He's a descendant
yes.
Of the original... Lieutenant.
Exactly. I had totally forgotten mm-hmm. about that connection. And actually, it's interesting because that actually is just an example of why I would have felt uncomfortable trying to tell the real Henry Allen story when there are people out there who are related to him that certainly know more about him than I do. And so by fictionalizing it, I can just kind of invent what I want to. But I love that there's some local connection. That's really great.
But what's interesting to me, too, though, you fictionalized it, but you make it seem so real because it's all a series of letters and then the illustrations that are the artifacts that look exactly like you'd see in a historical book.
Yeah.
And now, are those all fictional,
you know,
as well?
It's such a mix. So in some cases, they are actually photographs from the time. Some of them are like, one of them is a cabinet photograph that I bought on eBay. And some of them are photographs that I got permission from the Alaska State Historical Library to use. And others are photographs that I took that I had someone digitally age for me. There's real postcards and real old advertisements. So it was just fun. I know it seems like a strange thing that I did. What I wanted to do was fictionalize it, but then I wanted the reader to completely buy into it. I wanted it to feel really real to the reader so that they would maybe feel like they were opening this old trunk or crate and just sort of digging through and not really sure what they're going to find when they turn the page. But then hopefully in the end, it feels like a cohesive story.
And that's really the way that the whole novel unfolds. It's the old guy has the trunk right. of the all of the stuff from this expedition, and he's sending it up to a young museum curator in a town, a little town, a lot like Chickaloon, I'm
yes,
assuming.
A lot like Sutton, actually. It's so Sutton. Funny because my husband and I were caretakers at the Alpine Historical Park in downtown Sutton when we first
downtown
came back from
Sutton.
It's not much. You blink, you're going to miss it as you're driving through, as the saying goes. So parts of it are definitely people who are from that area will recognize certain places and certain, you know, aspects of the town, I think.
But then, and then the way the whole book is structured is it's brave and it's tricky to do it because it's all in these letters or the reports back from the expedition or the official reports, mm-hmm. the journal entries, it's all told that way. And then there's the couple of the modern guys that go back and forth that are trying to wonder what's happened, and the story right. unfolds. And what I just loved about the book were the way you used language and the change in voice for each of those things.
Oh,
I mean, that's,
thank you.
It didn't sound the same.
Good.
And, you know, and especially, I mean, I just, for me, and maybe this is just because I just love Sophie.
Oh,
the,
yay.
The wife of the expedition leader who yeah. has such a big character, and she's not on the expedition.
Right, right. She would love to be on the expedition, but she's stuck back in Fort Vancouver with all the officers' wives and struggling that. Yeah, and that was something, I mean, I did do a lot of research just reading diaries and letters from wives of polar expedition leaders and different things, and the reports and journals of the people on the expedition to try to get the language right, because that was something I felt like if I was going to do this, I didn't want to mess it up. I wanted to make it so that you were sure when you went from the colonel's diaries to Sophie's that you knew there was a change in voice, you know,
yes.
and it has to do with like sentence structure and word choice. And I became obsessed with the Oxford English Dictionary, because every time I would write or stumble on a word and think, would they have used that in 1885? I could look it up online on the OED and see exactly when it had been introduced and how it was used. And so I became a little obsessed about some of the stuff to try to get it right, because I didn't want to mess things up. I think it's kind of an illusion, you know, in fiction. It's sort of this dream that you hopefully allow a reader to step into. And I think when you get big things wrong, it can kind of shatter the illusion. And I've had that happen when I've read books about Alaska that get some little thing wrong. And I just didn't want to do that. So hopefully, fingers crossed.
Yeah, but the other thing about that is, though, as you're writing, do you find it then inhibiting? I mean, can you just sort of write along and then go back maybe later and double check? Or do you, you know, at what point does the research stop and the kind of the character take over?
Yeah, I think that it got easier as it went. So I think in the beginning, I was double checking more. But then I kind of got more comfortable with the voice. And then I would just sort of make a list of words that maybe I would check, or, you know, but there were silly little things, you know, like I remember becoming just obsessed about what kind of chocolate they had in 1885, because there was references to chocolate being brought on the expedition. But I didn't know, is that like a bar shape or a square? Where, you know, like, and these little things that you can just spend way too much time digging around online and looking at old books. But the fun part is when I would go on these little searches, oftentimes I would stumble across something totally unexpected that had nothing to do with what I was looking for. And then that would just sort of enhance, hopefully, creating this world even more, I think.
So you're describing then a lot of research done, I'm assuming, from your desk via mm-hmm. the computer. So how do you, what's your setup? Where's your home? Are you rural? Are you, and how do you, is your office in the house, and how do you work?
I owe so much to my husband, because he's always been really supportive. And when we bought this, another kind of typical Alaskan story, we bought this recreational cabin in Chicoloon that was completely unfinished. The only electricity coming into the house was an orange power cord through the sliding glass door. No water, no running water, no plumbing, all this stuff. But when we first bought it, he said, up there on the balcony, I envision a library. And I was like, oh, I always knew I loved you. You know, so he has built me a library, and he has also built me an office upstairs that's where I go and work. You know, and with both my daughters now in school, and our oldest graduated, actually, my husband goes off to work every day. So I just work in my little office with my books, you know, at my fingertips. But I have to say that I was fortunate in choosing 1885, which was purely based on the expedition date. But because of that date, all the material, so for example, if a photography manual was published in 1885.
Right, and Sophie's a photographer.
Exactly,
so
yes.
That plays yeah, big. So there's a lot of photography.
There
stuff.
Was, and I had to do a lot of research about it. But fortunately, a manual from that year is now out of copyright. So unlike Google Books, a lot of these have been digitalized. They've been scanned in. So I can pull up an 1883 photography manual and read exactly the terminology they use, what chemicals they were using. So, I mean, I don't know what writers did before the internet. I mean, you would have been like writing off to some library and saying, can you, you know, photocopy some pages? And I don't know. I don't know how you would do it. So I also got to do a lot more like physical research that I, with the Snow Child, I really didn't do any research. But with the new book, I did a float trip on the Copper River, very much thanks to the Rasmussen Foundation. I got an individual artist grant to do that. And then I also went down to Fort Vancouver and spent several days there with my mom, actually, just sort of just trying to experience what the place would have been like for Sophie when she was there for that year. So,
and does Fort Vancouver look at all like our Fort Seward?
You know, it does. It's funny you say that, because I was walking through as I was coming up here, and a lot of the buildings are very similar. There were a lot of similarities. It reminded me a lot. And then also just, you know, the beautiful lilac trees and different things that are planted around, very, very similar to Fort Vancouver.
Yeah, I thought about that when I was reading it. I kept thinking, I bet this is like our fort. And then the laundry and some of the issues were very similar. Similar, you know, it sounded like from what we hear about ours.
Yeah, and it was fun. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if you have this issue as a writer, but I as a newspaper reporter, I felt very comfortable saying, I'm from the Frontiersman and I would like you to interview you about this issue or this whatever. But as a novelist, it feels so weird. So I'm there at Fort Vancouver and I wanted to meet with the archaeologist and the historian, you know, and I was like, I'm a novelist. You know, like, is this a real job that I can make you spend time with? And they were so wonderful. They spent hours with me talking about the fort and telling me different things. So I've been trying to be braver about identifying myself as a novelist, like it's a real job or something.
I think at this point for you, it's a real job. I remember that Pulitzer Prize nomination.
Yeah.
just remember that.
I think none of it seems real yet, I guess. I don't know.
I think you're okay. What else I was going to ask you about the novel, that in some ways I wondered how, if you've had any reaction from Native organizations, mm-hmm. because throughout, you know, it's very much placed in 1885, so it's in that time, and much of the, you know, the point of view from the military is that conquering sort Absolutely. Of a thing, and how did you do that? And you also, again, your Native, the Natives that they meet along the way are fictional as
yeah.
well, so everything
yeah.
is, and it's not really a tribe. And then you also the only real similarity with the Snow Child is the magic.
Right, right.
And perhaps you could talk a
yeah,
little about that.
Absolutely. No, and it was something I was very much aware of as I was writing. And I think there's a really interesting discussion happening, and it's sort of intensified, about appropriation. You know, how can one culture write about another in a way that, you know, and there's some people who are saying, it doesn't matter, you just write whatever you want to, and you just have complete artistic freedom. And then there's other people who are saying, no, you have no right to try to describe someone else's culture or step into it. And I just tried to walk the middle, I guess, because I felt like to write a book about Alaska at that time and basically the beginning of colonialism, and to not talk about the effect on the indigenous populations and not to share parts of their stories would be kind of like putting blinders on. It's just not realistic. But also it was so much a part of the experience for these men when they were going up the river. And what I did is I got to a certain point in the book and I was feeling sort of increasingly uncomfortable. Like I wasn't sure I was doing things right. And I reached out to this wonderful artist, Argent Kovanoskov, who's up in Inilchik. He's part of the Inilchik tribe. And I had known him because he had arranged a book event for me. And I reached out to him and I said, hey, can I, you know, really young, artistic, intelligent, wonderful, articulate guy who I knew would be this, we'd have this great conversation. So I said, hey, will you talk with me on the phone about like your experiences growing up here and how you feel about the history of Alaska and all that. And it completely turned a lot of things upside down for me. I was so grateful for the time we spent together, and it kind of opened up all these other ideas. So in ways, a lot of his story and the things he had to say to me are shared in the book through the voice of Josh, who's mm-hmm. one of the modern characters.
Yes.
And so that was how I, you know, and then now Argent's gone on to have a wonderful art show in Homer. And so I got to go down and see that. So I feel like we've got this wonderful friendship that I'm so grateful for. And that's how I chose to approach it, and to try to be as knowledgeable and respectful as I could, but also include some of that stuff in there as mm-hmm. well.
And then the birds.
Yeah.
I love the flight connection with Sophie becomes a photographer of birds.
Right.
And then the part of the magic is that the women turn into geese, or
yeah,
they have feathers
yes.
on there, and they fly away, and these soldiers see this and
right.
are just kind of like, whoa, you know, you can hear the music playing and we are in a different world completely.
Yes.
So where did that come from?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I've had people say, do I have sort of like an artistic obsession with birds or something? And I really don't, but I do think that sometimes in fiction, symbols start to kind of pop up, and I started seeing connections in things. And I think I've always loved I have so much admiration for birders and their sort of meticulous attention. I don't have that patience. I don't have that knowledge of birds, but I love the idea of Sophie just sitting out there for so long trying to get this perfect photograph of a bird. And then it did start to tie into, you know, and there's also a raven character. So there's sort of these threads that come through. Sometimes I'm not really sure what all it means even to me, but I feel like there is some interesting stuff going on there.
Well, so that brings me to something too about like the whole creative process and not knowing necessarily where it goes. I mean, where do you think it comes from, and where do you think it's going when you find people who read your novel and they find all these things in it that you might not have even realized were there.
Oh, absolutely.
But it's not like an accident.
Yeah. No, and that's what I love about fiction, I think. I think that was the frustration I had as a newspaper reporter, is I felt like I felt like my newspaper articles, no matter how hard I tried, totally oversimplified the world, so that there were good guys and there were bad guys, and there were people who went to jail and people who prosecuted them. And it was this very black and white world that I just felt like never really told the true story, because I think there's just so much ambiguity in life. And that's what I love about fiction, is that I want to explore that ambiguity, and I want readers to, and I want them to discover things that I maybe is subconsciously feeling or thinking, but they're, you know, and they're bringing their own experiences to the page. And I love that. Like, I think there's so much excitement as a writer and a reader of fiction in that, I think.
Wow. Well, thank you so much. Oh, you know what? I did want to ask you one more thing, because your name, everybody's always stumbling to pronounce it. So pronounce it one more time.
So it's Eowyn. You pronounce the E like an A, which is what throws everybody.
And also, you were pretty much born literary, right?
I mean, right. Well, my mom, and this is a great chance for me to, my mom is a wonderful
poet. Yes.
And she actually just has her first book out from University of Alaska Press, The Echo of Ice, Letting Go. But yeah, my whole life growing
up. Name?
Julie LeMay. Yeah, I believe that. Julie. She's his mom, right? My mom, no, and I'm so proud of her. And the book is beautiful. And actually has a painting by a Juno artist, Ian Grant, is the painting that's on the cover of it. So it's really beautiful. But yeah, growing up,
She named you after
she named
a heroine
me after
in
The Lord of the Rings.
The Lord of the Rings.
Yes. She's the one who is on the battlefield, and this monster says, "No man will kill me." And she takes off her helmet and says, "I'm no man," and slays the beast. So, wow. But my mom was always reading, and but it's funny, nobody ever recognized the name growing when I was a kid. But now, with the movies out, sometimes I get young people coming, "That's so cool, it's from The Lord of the Rings."
Now, one more thing. Are you working on anything else now? I know that's the question that no writer wants to hear.
No, I'm always honored when people ask, because I'm glad that anybody cares. But the truth is, I find it hard. I've been traveling so much with the new book, and I just find it. It's just too interesting. My brain is too busy with all this to really, I almost have to be a little bored, I think, to sit down and write and have my mind sort of take off on these other adventures. So I'm hoping that this fall and winter, when I've got some quiet time, that things will start percolating. We'll see. Fingers crossed. I don't take it for granted, that's for sure.
Oh, wait. No, I did have one more thing.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. I was thinking about this, because I was in Juneau this winter recently, and I understand that The Snow Child is a musical, right?
Yes.
And it's in Washington, D.C. with another Haynes connection, Molly Smith.
Exactly.
Who has a home out at LUTEC here.
Oh,
but
wonderful.
She's the director,
yes.
Right?
And yes.
So how is that all
this
happening?
This is so amazing. So Perseverance Theater, Art, the artistic director there, reached out to me several years ago and said, you know, we're interested in optioning it and hopefully developing it into a stage production. And I think at that point he was hoping, you know, he wanted to work with Molly Smith, and they just have put this together and worked so hard, and it'll come out in Washington, D.C. at Molly Smith's Arena Stage there in D.C. In March of 2018, I'm pretty sure. And then my mom actually just texted me a photograph, because the Anchorage Concert Association brochure came out in everyone's mailboxes, and it's got The Snow Child in it, because it'll open in Juneau and Anchorage after that. So I'm so thrilled. And it's a musical with sort of a bluegrass Americana feel to the music, and I haven't seen it, so I'm just so thrilled to see how it comes out.
Oh, that's great. Well, yeah. Well, again, thanks very much. I guess I could just talk to you all morning, but
well,
we got
I could
other
too.
People I have to talk to. So
it was really wonderful, Heather. Thank you so much for having
me
on.
And really, if you haven't read The Snow Child, which by now you really should have, but especially To the Bright Edge of the World, I just think it's a great summer read, and it's really a good read for. For those of us in Haynes or Clukwan and Skagway, there's a lot in it that will really hit home. And speaking of American bluegrass music, Americana music, the Windy Valley Boys are our little musical interludes today. Wasn't that fun? I really could talk to her all day. She is a truly, of course, an extremely... talented and gifted writer, but she's just a delightful person, and it's always fun, right? We have Melina Shields is here right now.
Good morning,
and
everyone.
She's our reader today. But it's and you might find this sometimes happens. I know if you get a chance to meet a writer when you've been reading them, sometimes it's a little bit of a disappointment, because they're, you know, their art is so different than they are, and you have this imaginary person that. And I feel like I do that to people sometimes myself. They're like, "Oh, you're taller, or you're older, or whatever." But Eowyn, you know, completely better than you could imagine from reading her books. So great.
That was wonderful to listen to that. That was really great.
So, Melina, please introduce yourself.
Melina Shields, reader,
leader. You do a couple other things too, right?
Right, right. I make things. I think it's easy to say that, you know, it's easy to identify as an artist here in Haines, mm-hmm. right? And say I'm an artist, but I shy away from this. So what I'm saying it right now is I make things.
You know, I understand this. I went off to get an MFA, Master's in Creative Writing of Fine Arts, when, as an adult. You know, I got it in like 2011, so fairly recently. And that was our first sort of lecture was you are now writers and you have to the professor told us you have to have a room where you write, or like a own library and everything. And it's like, I write on the stair landing. I'm always hesitant to like identify as a writer, like with a capital W. And they just insisted that you got to do that. But even Eowyn, she novelist. Do I tell somebody I'm a novelist?
Right. It's it's a funny thing.
I
was actually writing an artist statement yesterday for an applying for an artist residency, and I know I should be better trained, you know, to be comfortable enough to write an artist statement, but I always feel like, well, just look at it. You either like it or you don't, you know, and we can talk about it.
Well, that's like poets will often say that. Why, if I have to explain my poem, like, what's the point of writing the poem?
What's the point of it? Right.
You are here because you're a reader, and we love to feature a reader on Art Matters, and hopefully this program will help you to boldly wear your art loud and proud, your art patch on your shoulder or whatever. Or perhaps it should be like a cape or something. But anyway, right. And I always like to talk with you because you read a lot of interesting books. And I'm wondering if there's something right now that has sort of struck you that you think we ought to read.
You know, this past year, I've read a lot and I listen to books a lot.
This is different. You listen rather than read.
Oh, I read a lot too, but admittedly in the last year or so, I've been doing too many things, and I can still listen to a book while I'm gardening. While it's like the radio, right? Mm-hmm. You can do other things while listening to it. And some of my more literary friends accuse me of not fully participating in the written word by listening to it. But I say that as a growing up as a child who had a mother who read to us all the time, that I love listening to somebody tell me a story. I think it's absolutely a legitimate way to go about it. So I went on my own little personal quest to sort of catch up on a lot of books that I haven't had time to read, and I just started going down the lists of Pulitzer Prize winners, lists of National Book Award winners, or even finalists, and I think my favorite couple of books from this past year, I listened to East of Eden.
John Steinbeck.
Yep. And that book to me is still one of the standout books of the past year. And I don't even know what year that was written, in the 40s or something.
It's a great book.
Fascinating.
Did you go ahead and like read The Grapes of Wrath? And
no,
then
no, I'm actually not. I'm really not. No,
I'm
not a Steinbeck fan.
But East of Eden is a sweeping novel.
Right, sweeping. And then, what I did was sort of go into a little California phase, and I went to Wallace Stegner.
Oh, I love Stegner.
And I read and I listened to every single book that I could find. And
did you have a favorite one of his? Or from that period that you
from
were...
From that period. The most recent one was called A Shooting Star, and the one before that was A Spectator Bird, which is a fascinating book, sort of written from this crotchety old man's perspective, who's sort of watching the world go by, and he gets forced into participating in life, and it's amazing. I loved it.
Great. And anything else?
Let's see. There's a little a book club. There's some book clubs going on. Yeah,
there's
on
a
the
lot
side.
Of book clubs. I love to hear the dipping into different book clubs. So
admittedly, I've just been talking about literature, right? There's at least one book club right now, and they're mostly reading books that have been turned into movies. And I'm admittedly not part of this book club. I've just sort of been spectating through the social media world, and I'm like, oh, well, I'll listen to that one too. And that's kind of dipped me into this whole other realm of books that I wouldn't normally read. Let's see, what was the last one? Big Little Lies is a Leanne
Moriarty. Yeah, she's the Australian writer.
And then a book called The Girls. And I'm sorry, I can't remember the author's name
Emma
right
Klein.
Now. Emma Klein. Yeah. Haunting story. I couldn't stop once I started that.
So I'll ask you one more question. Yeah. We got to get moving along and not take up too much of your time. But as you're a busy artist and you got to get creating, girl.
You know, you can also listen to books while you're making art. This is amazing.
But the question is, do you find that that some books are more listenable because of the voice, the reader, you know, and are there some that just sort of annoy you, even though the book is a good book, but the accent or the voice, or if they're changing?
Absolutely.
It's kind of a risk to have your book read out loud. And, you know, what if it doesn't sound the way you've.
Absolutely. Yes, I've absolutely stopped reading books or listening to books because the reader to me is a no-go. A really wonderful example of a book that I just listened to that I thought was incredibly well-read. It wasn't over-characterized. You know, the characters weren't too dramatized. And that was Claire Danes reading The Handmaid's Tale. And she just read it, and it was wonderful. I think it's maybe there's a tendency in the audiobook world to really want to bring drama into the way a book is read. And my preference is definitely to just listen to a book be read. And I really appreciated that book in particular because it was so easy to listen to.
Yeah, and I think the more, even having a voice, hearing somebody read a book, also you may remember it in a different way than when it's just the words, not just the words on the page, but
definitely.
It's a whole nother experience. It's almost a performance.
Yep.
So, wow. Well, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much
for coming in. We really appreciate it. And,
of course.
I've got to start. I don't listen, to books, really on tape or whatever we call it, or audio or podcasts. When I'm out alone, I'm in my own head to maybe come up with something else to write down, but I might start listening because maybe I need to get out of my own head a little bit.
Well, it's a wonderful escape, or it can be.
Well, or like A. Owen said in the interview, I think the thing that I'm holding on to just in relation to my own life from that interview is her discussion of the difference between journalism, being a reporter, and the black and white world of media versus the ambiguity of literature.
Sure.
And it's something to keep in mind that the world is full of gray areas and different. I think it's easier to find the good in different characters in a big sweeping novel or a literary work of nonfiction than it is in a short little article.
Well, I have one more little tidbit to say about audiobooks, and that is I have listened to a lot of things that I wouldn't read otherwise. And this is be it gray areas or information that I wouldn't necessarily spend my evenings reading about. But for instance, I've been listening to the original first edition Grimm's Fairy Tales from 1840 or something. I listened to the entire foreword because they were talking about how a lot of them have transformed. So I think they made 10 different editions, and in each one, some of these stories would carry over and change.
That's good, right, though. Evolve.
Right. Evolve. Well, and sometimes they changed, maybe not for the better, but they adapted. So gray areas, black, white, whatever. You know, there's room for it all. All right.
Thank you so much. Melina.
Thanks very much.
And you're listening to Lynn Canal Art Matters with Heather Lundy, Janine Allen, and we have a quick check-in with the Skagway Library, and then we have a couple of great guests coming in to join us, so I'll hurry through this. But
don't hurry. Take your time.
We want to make time for it all. I think we could sit here and talk about literature and art all day long. But I wanted to say huge thanks to Jalene Brown at the Skagway Library. She passed along in March. The Skagway Library had a tournament of books for people who might prefer books over basketball during March Madness. So she passed along a recommendation. It's the book that actually won the tournament of books out of a field of 8 novels. And it's The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead, which is a book that came out in the last year. And Jalene passed along the reader's synopsis of it. And I just wanted to share a couple of lines from it. The reader says, "I couldn't get it out of my head, lying in bed at night, pondering its bitter truths about human nature, prejudice, and the foundations of America. Whitehead, a descendant of slaves himself, creates an intriguing central character, Cora, a bright teenager who follows in her mother's famous footsteps and escapes the plantation where she is a third-generation field slave." The reader also goes on to say, "This novel moved me both emotionally and literally as I was carried away on the narrative's relentless current. It is an action-adventure novel and a heart-wrenching historical tale topped off with a touch of fantasy. The story will be in my head for a while. You should most definitely read it. But as another reviewer said, you'll want to clear your schedule first because there's no putting it down." Thank you to the reader and for that incredible overview, and really sold it. I like the idea of a
that's something maybe we can take up here on the program next March. We can do our own March Madness brackets for reading, and or maybe the library will pick that up, or the school. It's sort of like the I Did a Swim at the Pool, you know.
Yeah.
That we take a national sporting event and turn it into a reading or swimming or active locally.
I really like that.
I like that idea.
Many thanks to Jalene Brown at the wonderful Skagway Library. And the book again was The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead. We'll take a really quick music break with the Windy Valley Boys. And then stay tuned. We have a couple of great guests in the studio.
Hannah and Judy are here.
The Windy Valley Boys this morning on Lynn Canal Art Matters. And we talked to Melina Shields. Huge thanks to Melina for dropping by and talking about audiobooks. And then, of course, I just wanted to thank Eowyn Ivy, even though, you know, she's not here anymore. But I really enjoyed that interview with you, Heather. And
well, she did. She does the talking. It's really fun to hear.
And now I know how to pronounce her name.
Yes, Eowyn. Yes. Uh-huh. And we chose the day of the month for Art Matters because it lined up with the first Fridays.
Yes.
in Haines here. And so we do it the first Thursday. And first Friday, of course, is tomorrow evening in Haines. And there's a couple of things that I just want to let you know about. Vanessa Salmon, who is a multi-talented woman and also an artist, and her textiles woven on a hand loom are at the new Magpie Gallery on 2nd Avenue. So that's a good excuse to get over there. And Gene Kennedy has new Whale and Crow weather vanes, and he'll be at Alaska Fjord Lines. Natalie Helms, the CVN reporter, has jewelry at Alaska Rods. And Lindsay Johnson will do her Japanese fish rubbings, fish for thought, at the Art Confluence Main Gallery on Main Street. The museum has an archive grand opening. This is a big deal for the museum and their vast collection, and they encourage you to go down and see that. And the Portrait Society of America Alaska Members Show is also opening at the Sheldon Museum. We've got Hannah Bocart here right now, who Hannah will have an exhibit called Leftovers at the Distillery. And Judy Hall Jacobson, her books about native plants and mushrooms, et cetera, are going to be at Skipping Stone Studio. So, and Judy and Hannah are here right now. And
hi.
Just thought about that. What do these two people have in common, that if it's like my refrigerator, mushrooms grow on leftovers?
Sure.
And I know Merrick.
Yeah, and we're related. So
we're related. Right, we're all sort of living in Haines long enough. Everybody's kind of related.
Exactly. Works out.
So I guess, Judy, we'll start with you. Tell us about your books. You're also a naturalist and a guide. And, mm-hmm. you know, and my big question for you first with your books is I'm always a little afraid to pick mushrooms without somebody with me that is certainly sure, because they seem to look kind of alike sometimes, the ones that might kill you and the ones that taste really good.
And they do look a lot alike, but fortunately, the say 15 or so that are prime edibles, most of them are pretty easy to tell apart. Like, people know chicken of the woods.
Yeah.
You can't really mix it up with anything else. Shaggy manes.
Mm-hmm.
Chanterelles, those are ones you could easily learn, and you don't have to know all the mushrooms to eat mushrooms. You just have to know the ones you're eating, basically.
And then your guidebooks, you take there's photographs and, mm-hmm. and everything is then the descriptions. Do you take the photographs as well?
I took most of the photos. If I had a good one of mine, I'd use it. If not, I got permission to use other photos, but I'm trying to slowly turn them around to my own when I find good photos of mm-hmm.
Is there a trick to getting a good photograph of a mushroom to make sure that people pick the right one? Or
yeah well, it's good to have a decent camera.
that's about it.
Well, and it takes time, because mm-hmm. they're close up, so you really have to get everything in focus, and so yeah, it's a little bit of a challenge. But
so when we go to the to Joni's gallery here, what are we going to see in relation to your books?
Can you say Stepping Stone?
Skipping Stone? No, I can't.
No,
you can.
The gift store next to the bookstore.
No, you don't have to do that on this. Send people off, but we can talk about the location here. I guess there's all kinds of those rules, but I just want to make sure I said it right.
Right.
But,
well, yes. I'm going to show some of them. We'll have the books there,
mm-hmm.
and I'm also going to bring some photographs. Hopefully get some photographs ready by tomorrow night,
mm-hmm.
and that's about it. We're just showing the books, and
that's neat. I'm looking forward to seeing them all there. I think that's
I'm realizing.
And you've got, how many do you have now?
It depends on if you're counting the ones that are up on Amazon. It's mm-hmm. seven.
Seven.
But I did some books earlier. I worked on a book called We Like Kids, several songbooks,
uh-huh.
and We Like Kids.
Because that
song
was the
books.
Show. You were a radio producer for We Like Kids, and that came out of Juno.
Yeah,
right?
With Jeff Brown and Jan Konitz, mm-hmm. and we produced two or three. Four songbooks from the music.
Yeah, neat.
So, in fact, I have some with me. and then earlier I did a plant list for the forests of the Oregon State University's forests. So I did kind of a checklist of all uh-huh. the plants. So that was my first, and that was in 1982.
Wow.
So it's been like roughly 35 years of
putting out
different kinds of books.
Yeah. Now, and Hannah, this is my first chance to really see you publicly since, you know, on the radio, since your show.
Yes.
Right. Rusty Compass, Dusty Rose.
Yes.
Did I get the right order with those two?
Oh, yeah.
It was just fabulous.
Oh, thank you.
It was really something. I mean, if I was a reviewer, I'd call it a tour de force.
I'll take it.
And I know we're talking about your leftovers, but I think the thing that just struck me so much was the homegrown talent.
Well,
in that, yeah. And you yourself, maybe, will you please introduce yourself for people that don't? I guess I should have asked you both to do that. I didn't yet. But Hannah, introduce yourself the way that, however you'd like to.
I'm Hannah Bocart, local girl, raised out at the border. And I basically just fill up my spare time with writing and making art. It's something I really enjoy. I spend all my time reading. I do plays. And if I see something that I really want and it's not out there, I guess I just kind of have to make it myself. That's kind of how I go about with every artistic thing that I do. I just get bored and hankering for something that doesn't exist yet. And that's kind of how I've kind of stumbled into everything that I've accomplished in my life. I would say that much, but yeah.
I think you're being slightly modest though, because there's some stumbling, but there's an awful lot of work and craft and art.
Yeah, the stumble is the initial step,
it's not
and then
of a
there's years
thing.
Worth of work on top of that.
Mm-hmm. And talent.
Yeah.
Lots
thank
of
you.
Talent.
And it was funny when I did ask you earlier, what are you going to be doing for this first Friday? what is it? Because you're multi-talented. And so
yeah.
I've seen many, maybe you could explain some of the different mediums or different.
Sure. Well, I've kind of done a different medium with every show that I've done, just because I like to dabble. This time around, I'm doing some multimedia assemblage pieces. And a lot of that just stems from my entire life. I've been a horrible pack rat. If I see a cool bit of junk or a stone, I'm going to pick it up. And I've got boxes and boxes of stuff in my tiny little shack. So I thought I might as well put this together into something that other people might enjoy. So it's a lot of found objects, a lot of bits and bobs that I've had lying around kind of put together. And then I've also got pages and pages of unused poems that I've written. So I've kind of cut those up and incorporated original bits of poetry into each little piece.
Right, and you do that with I've seen other mm-hmm. works that you've done. You do stories mixed up with pictures.
Yeah. This one's going to be a little bit, a show that I did, was that last year or the year before, was kind of poems in their entirety, which were great, but they were a little bit too large. They didn't move very well because, people only have so much room in their homes. So this time around, I decided to go for a much smaller approach. There's not complete poems, but little bits and bobs, a word here and there that hopefully when all put together will be a complete art piece. Not hopefully, definitely. I'm confident in this.
Now, Judy, I didn't give you a chance to introduce yourself the way you'd like to be introduced or to our wider audience, so please do
I'm
that.
Mostly a naturalist, but I also dabble in music. I like playing the ukulele and the writing part, and I've been in Haines for 15 years and Juneau before that, so a long time in Alaska, mm-hmm. and did radio for a while, too.
Right. Now, do you see yourself as an artist?
Well, photography is art.
Yes.
So that's, I think, what Joni had in mind mm-hmm. when she invited me to do this. Mm-hmm. It fit in.
And now, do I say ukulele? Ukulele, what's the
Hawaiian way of saying it would be ukulele.
Oh, yeah, so, and you spend some time in Hawaii and mm-hmm. know that better than I do. But there's a whole group of women that play, right?
Yep.
Women and men?
And they're going to play at the church on the Presbyterian Church
on
Saturday
night.
On Saturday night?
Oh. With the Juneau Youth Choir
and
the Men of
this.
Note.
Yeah. The Men of Note, mm-hmm. I'm going to be riding my bicycle in Tagish.
Maybe
I would
record
have loved
it.
To hear it.
Yeah, that's
so
it.
Explain this. Who's going to be there?
So it's the Juneau Youth Choir. That's at the Presbyterian Church Saturday at 6:30 p.m. And the choir will be joined by the Men of Note and the Haines ukulele singers, ukuleles.
I think they changed it to singers because we have one guy.
Oh, now there's a guy, so I can't be ukulele. Well, that is, so I do want to ask both of you while you're here even too, and, mm-hmm. and Hannah, you've pursued a whole life now of art. Why does it matter to you?
I think a lot of it just has to do with the way that we were raised was, it was the 90s. It was incredibly remote. We didn't have TV. All that we had were my siblings and I, and we were all prolific readers because, honestly, we had to be. that just led to a lot of make-believe. I mean, we were outdoors all the time, and we really had to find ways to entertain ourselves, so it just kind of programmed my brain in that way. You know, I think I didn't have a choice but to get into theater. When I went to college, that was, you know, the only thing I was going to pursue. And, you know, I getting my degree was just the natural next step. It's just what I've done my whole life. Similarly with, you know, painting and making art and being a songwriter, it's just the things that you do to entertain yourself, it just kind of hotwires your brain, and that just kind of becomes your natural go-to. And it's, and even now, the way I live very remotely right now, you know, I was working on this show, doing the final touches last night by candlelight, because that's the only way I light my house. in fact, I was having a hard time getting my hands clean enough to touch the paper and whatnot, because I don't have running water. So I think, a remote Alaskan living just really sets you up to kind of have a more cerebral, artistic life, because you don't have the distractions that most other people have in other parts of the world. You kind of are self-sufficient, and it just kind of basically, I'm saying I didn't have a choice. It's just the way all, you know, my siblings and I, all of us have gone into the artistic arenas, and good parenting and a lot of nature. That's the ingredients.
Aren't we lucky? Yeah. Now, Judy, what about you? You talk about the We Like Kids. Your brain is, I see you nodding your head.
Well, I was just thinking about just living in Alaska makes it easy to do art of many kinds, and write books, as mm-hmm. you have as well, yeah. because there's so much inspiration from nature, and we have it all around us, and we live in a place where we're surrounded by wilderness rather than little pockets of wilderness surrounded by humanity. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps a lot to urge us on to do artistic things, so art matters.
Yes, all right. Well, thank you very much. I think we have to sort of wrap up here. Is that what's going on?
First Friday is tomorrow from 5 until 7.
And so we've got, again, Judy Hall Jacobson and her books, many of them, about native plants and mushrooms, etc., are at Skipping Stone Studio. And Hannah Bocart, her leftover assemblages are going to be at the distillery, where there's plenty of room because you can go out on the porch too. Mm-hmm. And the other things that are going on that we know of, but there may be more, so please forgive me if I didn't mention it, but Vanessa Salmon will have her textiles at the Magpie on 2nd Avenue. That's that old little shop that used to be like the expedition broker mm-hmm. down the street there. And Jean Kennedy has new whale and crow weather vanes at Alaska Fjord Lines. Natalie Helms, the reporter from the Chilkat Valley News, has her jewelry at Alaska Rods. And Lindsay Johnson, a troller and a ski maker, also mm-hmm. has beautiful Fish for Thought prints at the Arts Confluence Gallery. And the Sheldon Museum has the archive grand opening. They've been working on this for a while. It's a big deal. And also this Portrait Society of America Alaska member show is opening. So
it'll be a great First Friday.
Yes.
Thank you, ladies, both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Have a
See
great
you all
day.
There.
Well, we are coming to the end of the show, Heather.
I know, I can't believe it. The hour goes so fast. We could do this for a couple of hours. I feel like, I want to hear more from Hannah and Judy and Melina and Eowyn, the whole thing. And the Windy Valley Boys, it would be nice to get like a whole song in with those guys. But I do, speaking of the Windy Valley, I want to let you know that if you're in Skagway, you are really lucky because the Northwoods Writers Symposium is continuing and you can meet some really fabulous authors. Today, there's a book signing at the Skagway News Depot and books at 11:30 to 1. It's Paul Thoreau.
Oh my gosh.
Like, you know, the best travel writer around. And then from 2 to 3 o'clock, it's Tom Keziah, New Yorker writer, Papa Pilgrim, and also Andy Hall, who wrote Denali's Howl, fantastic book about a storm on Denali, and was a longtime editor of Alaska Magazine. He'll be there 2 to 3. And then tonight, from 7 to 9:30, there are the faculty readings at the Park Service Auditorium, so you can hear the faculty read from their works, including, I do want to add, one of the faculty members is a contemporary, a little bit of Hannah's, a very similar story. Lenora Bell, a.k.a. Nori Nash, is a best-selling romance bodice ripper writer, and she is one of the presenters there. And Nori will be signing her books from 9:30 to 10:30 tomorrow at the Skagway News Depot, and that's followed by John Straley and Sherry Simpson, who will also be signing books, both real well-known Southeast writers.
And I love this, Heather. Somebody just came in and passed me a note. The Windy Valley Boys play tomorrow evening.
Oh, so we must be telepathic.
Well, thank you for a great Lynn Cannell Art Matters, and I will look forward to checking in next month.
Yes.
And it's just about time.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. You're listening to KHNS, Haynes, Skagway, and Klukwan. The World Cafe is coming up next. Just wanted to say a last word of thanks. Thanks so much to everybody who joined us on the program today, including AO and Ivy and Melina and Judy and Hannah. Thanks so much.
Hey, you're listening to The World Cafe. I'm Talia Schlanger. Today is the anniversary of the release of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Well, it was really 50 years ago today that Sgt. Pepper's came out, and no matter how many times you've listened to the album, get ready to hear it in a totally new way, thanks to a remix by Giles Martin. He's the son of Sgt. Pepper's original producer, Sir George Martin, and he worked to bring the songs as close as possible to Sir George's original vision. He'll play examples and talk to NPR Music's Bob Boylan about the project. You'll also hear a little bit of our interview from 2006 with Sir George Martin about releasing an album this eccentric back in 1967.
To begin with, I was a little bit scared that we were pushing our frontiers too rapidly and maybe people wouldn't catch up with us. But I was wrong, because when the record came out, everyone was with us.
50 years of Sgt. Pepper's coming up on The World Cafe. Let's start with a classic.